folks, it's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone.
Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Steve Williamson here. We've got a full studio, Michael Costantino.
We have a whole lot of guests from Tucson. Lots happening down there. We have a great show. The name of the show is Democratic Perspective, and we're certainly going to look at this perspective of one of the big immigration issues as far as many of us are concerned, and that's people coming across the border and the humanitarian care, or at least outlook, on that, on this particular, some people call it a crisis, some people call it normal human migration. So we're going to talk about those things. We have with us this morning, Sula Fever wrote a really interesting book called No More Deaths. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Sue before we get into this. Sula Fever is a native Arizonan, has a master's degree in elementary education from Arizona State University. She worked with the Arizona-Mexico Commission and the Phoenix Sister Cities Commission, taking hundreds of students, parents, and teachers to visit Hermosillo, Sonora, Mexico, and hosting their counterparts in Phoenix to facilitate cross-border understanding. Real important. A lot of these school programs, I've been involved in some in my career, were wonderful for both everybody involved. She supported her husband Gene in his work during the 1980s with the sanctuary movement in southern Arizona. During that period, Central Americans were fleeing death squads and other violence in their home countries and sought asylum in the United States. When 11 humanitarians were charged with transporting and harboring people running for their lives, Gene became president of the Arizona Sanctuary Defense Fund, and raised over $1 million. Now we want to talk about her book, No More Deaths. The book is about humanitarian crisis in southern Arizona since the passage of NAFTA, which is a whole different component we can talk about, in 1994. Sue is thankful for the voices of the many volunteers. As you can imagine, Sue, good morning. Tell us a little bit about, give us what's going on. What do you guys do down there?
Well, after NAFTA was passed, people began to come into Arizona and Texas and California trying to get, because they couldn't eat. When we passed NAFTA, we dumped 4 million barrels of corn on Mexico, and they couldn't grow corn as cheaply as we were able to send it to them. And so people who had farmed all their lives were coming north. And as we realized that, several organizations were formed in the Tucson area to meet the need, because people were dying. There was, in about 2000, there was a young woman, Elisama, and her baby were found, and her baby had just died. And we'd been hearing about it, but that really galvanized the people in Tucson.
They were found in the desert, Sue.
They were found in the desert.
In these very, very austere, hard, and dangerous places, and the baby had died on the way crossing into the U.S.
Right. The desert is unrelenting. We find in Arizona, we've had about 3,000 recovered human remains, which are bodies or skeletons, in the desert since 2004. And we know that that's only a small number.
Well, that's it. One of the sources I was looking at before the show was, they called it a slow motion disaster. That, as you just said, you read about a death here or a death there. But 3,000?
3,000. It's just incredible. And when you plot those on a map, it just covers the whole map. It's amazing. And we've had people come from all over the country, all over the world, to Tucson to work in the desert and at the borders to try to meet the needs of the people who are coming.
Now, this is a wonderful thing. And then what the show is kind of about this morning, we run into resistance to the humanitarian efforts of your movement, of which would, you know, it makes sense through some actions of the United States government. People find themselves not able to feed their families. They do something about that. In some cases, they travel north, and they had some humanitarian aid. And then the government decides what? That they don't want you to do this anymore?
And I think you should tell folks, Sue, when you answer Mike's question there, what exactly your organization does. So for people who don't know about No More Deaths and stuff,
tell us
exactly what you're doing.
Well, No More Deaths was formed in 2004. It was the third major organization that was formed that does direct humanitarian aid. And we went out in the desert in 2006 and established a camp. And some people may know Bird Baylor. She's written a lot of children's books, and she had a piece of land that was in a great place near the town of Aravaca. So first we established that camp.
Amigo was the name of one of her books.
Amigo was the name of one of her books, that's right. She writes beautifully and has a wonderful illustrator, Parnell. So then No More Deaths has just expanded enormously. Gene and I moved back to Phoenix from Tucson in 2013, and we actually live in Phoenix now. But since we went down there in 2007, it's just grown like Topsy.
All right. What are you doing exactly? Somebody's coming across the border. You're giving them water if they run out of water. What exactly does the organization
do? Well, there are about 2,000 to 2,500 trails that we have hiked and have been mapped by a geology professor from the U of A and other volunteers. And we hike those trails every day and leave water, caches of water, food, first aid, blankets, in various locations where we're sure people are going to be. And then in 2006, we started the border ministry in Nogales. And people are arrested by Border Patrol, and often they're just directly taken back to Nogales or Douglas or Naco and left to fend for themselves. Often they don't have their money. Their money is back in the court in Tucson, and so part of that program is for us to help people get their belongings back. They're called pertenencias. They pertain to those people.
I see.
And we give haircuts at the border. We let people make phone calls. We do everything we can to help them get adjusted for their time while they're in Nogales.
Let's fast forward, and we can go back if we need to, but let's fast forward to the Scott Warren trial, and that's what's in the news in the last year or so. So we're in 2019 now, and the government arrests Professor Scott Warren, has a doctorate in geology from ASU, I believe, and he is part of your organization.
Right.
And his trial and his arrest, let's start with that, becomes big news.
It does, partly because the government had been leaving us alone for almost 10 years. We had trials in 2008 of two young men, Dan Millis and Walt Staten. And they went. Dan's court case went to the Ninth Circuit, and they threw it out. So the government had pretty much been leaving us alone and letting us go on the refuges. There's a enormous Buenos Aires National Wildlife Refuge that touches the border. And we've had been putting water out there for a long time. Then recently, the last 5 years, we've started working in Ajo. And there's quite a group of volunteers there who provide resources for people who are coming. Some people may remember The Devil's Highway, which was a book that was published in 2004, and it was about the deaths in 2001 of 14 people who were going along what they call the Devil's Highway, which is right next to Ajo, and Ajo is in southwestern Arizona. So when they started doing that, they've just found body after body after body in that area. And Scott was doing his doctorate, and he went down there and studied that and actually started living there.
Ajo's about 40 miles from the border, and it's not called the Devil's Highway because it's evil. It's called the Devil's Highway because it's hot.
And people die there.
And people die there.
Right. So Scott was arrested in January of 2017.
What was he charged with?
Well, initially with...
What's the crime, I guess, as I'm asking for?
He's harboring. He was harboring. He was trespassing on the refuge. He was conspiring with people in Mexico to help the people who came through. There were two men, young men who were arrested with him. So in his trial, they tried to prove that Scott had talked with this Mr. Sicario from Sonoyta and made arrangements for these two young men to come up to Ajo. Well, he hadn't done that.
So they're accusing him of smuggling, and that's not what he's doing. He's helping. He's not helping people smuggle.
No, these
the
people arrived at a place called the Barn in Ajo that a woman has let the humanitarian groups use. And when Scott went to bring food and water to the barn, he found those men there, and they were there for 3 or 4 days, resting up before they were going to go on their journey. So now, on July 2nd, they reconvene, the prosecutors and the defense and the judge, and the prosecution said they wanted to move forward with trying Scott again.
Okay, what happened with the first trial, Sue?
It was a hung jury, 8-4. 8 voted to acquit him, and 4 voted to find him guilty.
So it's rare, right, Mike, to retry when it's an 8-4 hung jury, particularly when you've got 8 for acquittal.
Let me read you a little quote from The Intercept. Warren's arrest was the most aggressive in a series of escalating actions taken by federal law enforcement agents against border-based aid providers since Donald Trump's election. In addition to his felony case, Warren was one of 9 No More Deaths volunteers hit with federal littering charges. I mean, come on. When they use the word aggressive prosecution, they're not kidding.
No, they're not. Prior to Scott's arrest, there had been 8 young women who were arrested in 2 groups of 4. And the first group pled guilty to a misdemeanor of going on to the Cabeza Prieta Wildlife Refuge, and the other 4 pled to some civil disobedience, and they all paid fines of $250 each. So that's the first money we've paid. Otherwise, we've gotten away from, you know, gotten out of it.
So that's the way it's been. But they charged Scott with very serious crimes.
Oh, they
put
did.
Him on trial. Got 20 a hung
years.
Jury. Now they're doing it again?
Yeah, he would have faced 20 years in that first trial. And in the second trial, now he's facing 10 years. They have him on a harboring charge for this next trial.
It's easier to prove the harboring.
How is he harboring, Mike, do you think? I mean, he's providing food and water, but
I think the harboring charge in my, and Sue can probably, we're talking to Sue LeFever, author of No More Deaths here on Democratic Perspective this morning, and please check out the book. But one of the things we are talking, I think where the harboring charge comes from, and we're also talking about the arrest of Scott Warren, which has been in the news a lot in the last 6 months, is this the few moments they spend together during an exchange of food and water is harboring. Is the way
they're staying in a place called the Barn. So there's a physical location, and I guess they believe that he's harboring those people in that location.
Because he's there, too, at the same time
too.
They are.
Right, exactly.
And even though he arrives later or whatever, he's still
harboring them.
And so they're retrying him. And what is the retrial looking like? I mean, is he being tried in federal court?
Federal court in Tucson. And
November
it starts
12th,
on the 12th of November, which is a week from tomorrow.
I'm sorry, say that again.
A week from tomorrow, November 12th, 2 days after my birthday, they're going to retry Scott on harboring charges.
So are there going to be demonstrations protesting the retrial?
Absolutely.
Because retrial is kind of rare.
It is rare.
Especially for this kind of thing. I mean, it's like if a guy is a murder charge, Mike, or something like that. But this is, to retry this is they must really want to get him. Or basically, they want to get all you guys.
It's an example.
Yeah.
We understand that they had changed their policies. They wouldn't give no more deaths a permit to go on Cabeza Prieta. And we had knew from some radio intercepts that that they really wanted to get us. So they are after us. No More Deaths in particular, but also the other humanitarian groups. There's Samaritans there. They're Border Angels. There's another California group that all work in the Ajo area.
Is there any single entity or that you would blame for this? I mean, is it strictly Trump policy changes? Or are there individuals within the Border Service or within the administration that seem to be really targeting this?
Well, the Border Patrol Union supported Trump. And, I think it's coming from the top, at least the pressure and the change in policy.
One of the things I want to mention is that some of the underlying issues here, I mean, you know, that Warren's story, and he's wonderfully says something. The kinds of things he says are beautiful. I mean, compelled to help these people. It wasn't like I had a choice. This is what being he is religiously motivated, but this is what being a human is all about. And when you have an opportunity to help like this, he doesn't see that there is a choice. He doesn't see that there's some policy change that is on the actions of the United States causing the deaths of innocent men, women, and children. Once again, I'm going to read a quote. People have been dying in the desert for decades because U.S. policy deliberately funnels them there. The Trump administration has doubled down on that approach while adopting a strategy popular among far-right regimes around the world, in which humanitarian organizations such as SOOS No More Deaths, working to keep migrants alive, are prosecuted as criminal enablers. This is a standoff of biblical proportions, and just makes you mad, doesn't it?
It makes you very angry and frustrated. People wouldn't keep coming back, and many people who've moved to Tucson in order to be involved in the work year-round. They come for a week and they stay a year or two or three or four because it's so compelling. The migrants give as much to us as we do to them with their courage and their spirit and their love. And it's after the sanctuary trial in the 1980s, Sister Darlene Nagorski, the judge told her that she couldn't go back and do anything in the desert anymore. She couldn't help these people. And she said, "Judge, if you had seen what I have seen, you would know I have to do this. And when I get out of this court, I'm going right back to work with these people." And that's how many, many people, and certainly Scott, feel that way.
How many people are involved in these different organizations, say, all together, your organization? You may not want to say, but...
Well, and I don't know. Our mailing list is about 10,000, and a lot of that are people who have come in the past and stay on the mailing list and donate to No More Deaths.
Do you run into militia groups at all down there?
Some, but not very often. And we're the only group out there that doesn't have guns. And the Border Patrol and the militia and some of the ranchers and other people have guns, but they know we don't. And so we're no physical threat to people.
And the militia groups are, maybe it's a lot just publicity for their cause, which is making sure nobody gets across. And they're not really there that much. Somebody told me they're there in winter, but not so much in summer.
Well, yeah. The joke is that they sit in the back of their pickup trucks with a gun and a can of beer and on a reclining chair watching the border. But I don't know. We don't see them a lot, but okay. We know they're there.
That's great. That's good to hear because in my mind, and I think a lot of others, we sort of see this unfair standoff between the humanitarians and these far-right militia groups that, as you say, are well-armed, and it just seems a very dangerous situation to those of us that haven't participated in
it. But there have been no attacks on your people by any groups or by the
Border
Patrol?
The only people that have raised guns to us are Border Patrol.
Okay.
And that's just a few times.
Yeah. I want to read another Scott Warren. So we're talking about the trial of Scott Warren coming up November 12th down in Tucson at the federal courthouse. You might want to, if this cause interests you at all, maybe you want to look into it a little more. We're talking to Sue LeFevre, author of No More Deaths. We're going to talk about her book in just a second, but I do want to another Scott Warren quote. As he was acquitted, at least not found guilty due to a hung jury, when the government tried to prosecute him for helping people at the border, providing food, water, shelter, he says, "Today it remains as necessary as ever for local residents and humanitarian aid volunteers to stand in solidarity with migrants and refugees. And we must also stand for our families, friends, and neighbors in this very, in the very land itself is more threatened by the militarization of our borderland communities." At the time he said that, it was the government announced right away that they were going to go for another trial on July 2nd. This was back in June. The second trial apparently isn't happening until November 12th. So the aggressive stance of the government against humanitarian aid, which seems, once again, anti-American. I don't understand. I just don't understand. So I don't why a government would want to prosecute its own citizens for humanitarian aid.
I don't know that one of the slogans that came out of Daniel and Shanti's trial in 2006 is the expression humanitarian aid is never a crime. And the courts have never really said, they've never affirmed that.
Either way, and let's drop back a second, Sue, and tell us why you got involved personally in this campaign. Why did you and your husband get involved in it? What drew you to it as individuals? You're living in Tucson, right, at the time?
Well, we were living in Phoenix, and our friend John Fife asked Gene to come down and be involved because he had been involved in the sanctuary movement in the late 80s, and he knew that the community in Tucson was going to be doing something, and he wanted a Phoenix presence as part of that. So Gene went, and it just is so compelling. Then we moved there in January of 2007. And I thought, my goodness, this is really something that's happening. And I knew that 23 books had come out of the sanctuary movement, and I thought, I'm going to write a book about this. And so I just began to gather data and talk to people. I have 34 volunteers who have contributed pieces to the book, and there are a lot of individual stories about people and their response to what's happening.
Very comprehensive book.
Yep. I posted the cover of this on my Facebook page this morning. The front cover says, "Humanitarian aid is never a crime, saving lives of migrants." The back cover says, "Humanitarian aid is always legal." So from either standpoint, and that's kind of a principle that I think we're talking about
right.
here, which is a little larger than people always talk about, well, you're breaking the law. Well, there are some principles that are of greater consideration, and certainly humanitarian aid seems mm-hmm. like one of them. And so your book, you said, is stories.
Yes, many stories, a lot of data. No More Deaths has done 6 reports on the abuses of Border Patrol, and parts of those reports are in the book. There are a lot of resources in the book.
Any chance of any legal action on the abuse against the Border Patrol for the abuses?
Oh, I doubt it. Certainly not in this administration.
So the Border Patrol is kind of just not, I maybe I phrase it, they're not just sort of neutral in doing their job. I have a job. It's in there. They're really angry at you guys, and they're angry at the immigrants, and they're angry at not being able to stop the immigration. And so they're going beyond what they should be doing just to enforce the law, you think?
I think that's true of some people. Other people are really trying to help the migrants and follow the law.
They do rescue the migrants, not border, to give the Border Patrol its due. It does rescue migrants, too. It does.
Yes, and it has an arm called Borstar, and Borstar's mission is to rescue migrants.
Yeah, we referred to the arrest of Daniel Strauss and Shanti Sells in 2005, and it's kind of where when the humanitarian aid is never a crime came out of. The judge at the time, in dismissing the charges, by the way, Judge Collins, I'm going to read a quote just because I'll screw it up otherwise. Judge Collins dismissed all of the charges against Sells and Strauss on September 1st, 2006. The judge stated that at the time of their arrest, the two volunteers were following a protocol that had been previously established by the U.S. Border Patrol, and no more deaths. Judge Collins stated that Sells and Strauss had made an effort to ensure that their actions were lawful and that further prosecution would violate the defendant's due process rights. Now, that's an important precedent for you guys.
Yes, it is. The Border Patrol and No More Deaths and the other humanitarians did have an agreement up until that point. And Daniel said, you know, one day we'd go by and wave hi to the Border Patrol, and the next day they arrested us. It just was a change. And part of the reason that Rainer Collins, the judge, let them go was because they were not informed. The No More Deaths and the humanitarian groups were not informed of the policy change by the Border Patrol.
So there was really an informal understanding of what you could do and what you couldn't do.
Right. It was not a written document, but it was an informal understanding.
And they were following, as the judge says, right, Mike, that they're following the informal understanding, and the Border Patrol changes the informal understanding without notifying them, and that's part of the reason they were released.
That's right. And we followed the National Red Cross humanitarian standards, as well as we have our own philosophy and principles. You know, we have theoretical bases upon which we do our work, and it's all within the law. It's open. We let people know what we're doing. We're not trying to hide anything. Maybe a little bit about the strategy for the trial, but generally you know, everything is available to the outside world.
The book is 600 pages. It is a document, I think, certainly to be proud of and a necessary one. How has it been received, the book? It's only been out a short time.
Yeah, a couple of months. Well, the people who've read it love it. You know, they say, well, it's heavy and it takes me a long time. It's taken me a long time to read it. But they read it and read it to the end, and I think they feel like they have a lot more information about what's happening at the border. I do not go into what's been happening the last couple of years with the influx of people from Central America. I just mention it at the end, and the behavior of President Trump toward the migrants and the children and all of that. I just felt I couldn't deal with that. And so
this is a long developing story, Sue.
It is. And this one starts in really with NAFTA and then the beginning of the groups in early 2000.
I think many of our listeners might know of a sort of a counterproductive aspect of NAFTA, which was to destroy rural farming in northern Mexico, the flooding of it with inexpensive, high factory-style American grains, took small farmers who were growing corn and other grains. It just devastated their economy, and that generated a lot of the very nice folks that come across. Where's the book available, and do you have a website? How would people contact you?
Well, the book is available on Amazon, Where else?
Yeah, of course.
And it's available on Kindle. You can get Kindle. If you have Prime, you can probably get it free. And it's easy to read on Kindle. I have a website, suelefevre.com, suelefevre.com. And I'm on Instagram and Twitter, and I'm just beginning to learn how to take advantage of all of that. I'm not a young chick, so I've got to get my grandchildren to help me with those things.
Okay, so Sue LeFave, as I've been mispronouncing your name for the last 30 minutes, and you have
tisk. It's usually me mispronouncing people's names, not mine. There are people in the studio.
I'm the ethnic name expert here.
Right.
But we can find you. Spell your last name again.
LeFevre.
Very good.
That's right.
And you can go to the website. You can find the book. You can buy it from our local Literate Lizard bookstore.
Oh, good. Good.
At least you can hopefully find it available there.
You can order it through them if they don't have it.
I was going to say, you can order it through them. Adventures Unlimited in Cottonwood on Main Street, by the way, one of my favorite bookstores over on that side. Literate Lizard over here, of course. Adventures Unlimited over there. We'll also, Rennie has it on her shelf.
Mean Sedona and Cottonwood, not across the street from each other, right?
Not across the street from two different cities. Anyway, she has it on her shelf, and she will also order more copies if you need some.
What are the people like who are members of your? It's kind of beyond an organization. It's kind of a movement that began quite a few years ago to help undocumented people who are in danger because of their trying to cross the border illegally.
That's an interesting question. We did some research on it in 2009, 10, 11, and the average age of the volunteers who came to us was 27.
Wow.
And the people who are there are, some of them are younger, but a lot of them have finished college and are doing like a, what is it you do when you, a Peace Corps. They consider it like the Peace Corps to come there and spend some time giving to the other people before they get their real job.
And then some of them, I mean, they have to be young to hike some of these trails, particularly in summer when it's most dangerous to the immigrants, right?
Well, we have a lot of older people who hike those trails.
Did you have a husband back there in the back of the back of the studio who gets out there and
he gave up at about 85.
Oh my God!
Wow.
Well, in fact, 2 years ago we went down to Ajo and he hiked in the desert with the Ajo people. So, in fact, there are not many middle-aged people, especially people with children. It's mostly the young people and then the gray hairs.
Mm-hmm. We want to remind everybody, Sue will be at Sedona Library today at 3 o'clock. If you'd like to meet her, if you want to talk about her book, you want to hear about her experiences with No More Deaths on the border of Arizona and Mexico today, right, Sue?
That's right. And my husband will be with me.
All right.
Good. Good. So tell us one of the stories about somebody coming across the border. I mean, it starts with the sort of collapse of the rural agricultural economy in northern Mexico, the intensity, and now it's switched to the absolutely crime-ridden, collapsed, failed governments in Central America who are also going to get impacted, I'm told, by the global warming more than almost anybody else because of
the poverty, especially in Honduras, is really difficult. But the people who have been coming have been desperate. You know, they wouldn't leave their homes if they weren't, even as early as 2000. I had a thought, but I've lost it.
I want to remind people to, once again, there's an article on the Internet called Bodies on the Borderlands that is quite comprehensive article, by the way. And it has as wonderful photographs of everything we're talking about. It has a picture of the barn. It certainly has a lot of pictures of the people that we're talking about, both the volunteers and the migrants, at least those that whose images could be put on film. So you might want to look for Bodies in the Borderlands, a wonderful comprehensive article written June of this year, right after the first Scott Warren trial. It says much more than we can say in the 44 minutes of this show. But yes, go ahead, Sue. I'm sorry.
Well, you asked about a story.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you Gene's favorite story. He and two others were hiking at a place near a Apache well, and they came up a rise. There's a lake there too. They came up a rise and they saw a woman, and one of the women with Gene, Annie, had been calling out, "Podemos ayudarles. We can help you. So, estamos de la iglesia. We're from the church. We can help you." Not everybody's from the church, but we say that because people respond to that. So she popped up, and so they sat with her and talked to her. And after a while, she gestured, and two little kids came out. Well, it used to be that it was just the young men who were coming, but now, because it's so difficult to go back and forth across the border, the mothers and children are coming as well, and they plan to stay. They don't plan to go back and forth. So the woman's name was Aurora, and she said, in Spanish, she said, "Well, I prayed for an angel, and three angels came."
That's a good
story. Was a time, particularly younger folks may not know, when the border was fluid, when people came back and forth without all these inspections and trouble, and where people lived in Mexico and worked on the American side and lived in the U.S. and worked over there and went over there to have dinner. And whether you were in the military or you were a civilian, I mean, there were places in El Paso where very, very friendly relations have existed all these years.
That's right.
I think people don't know that what the border was like, and that the fact that the whole border areas are a mixture culture. I think some of it came out in the campaign when one of the candidates for president was from El Paso. That sort of border culture where people speak Spanish and English, and everybody's used to working. The thing that I think that O'Rourke made of course is that people get along pretty well. I mean, we don't have this, like, I don't know if somebody's listening in Iowa or somewhere. Deep along the border, get along, Anglos and people from Mexico and Central America. It's not like we're really enemies or anything. It's like we're really sort of compatible, and we kind of like each other. That's hard for people who are away from the border, who don't have any experience with it, to understand. But we're kind of at peace with all this.
That's very true, Steve. It's people have a sort of a movie image of a border, turnstiles, and then there's plenty of that on the border. But there is a whole, it's a big long border, and there's lots and lots of ways of traveling that, of negotiating that particular thing, and especially that, as you said, the problems another U.S. policy has caused. With the inability to easily go back and forth, separating families yet one more time in a serious and almost permanent way, or at least a much more difficult way, has generated a lot of the problems that we have with
trade,
migrants.
Mike. And when I saw on the border was thousands of Mexicans coming over and buying stuff at Walmart and taking it back to Mexico, and thousands of Americans going over to Mexico and buying stuff and having dinner and touring. It was a free exchange. I mean, it's good for the local economy.
Absolutely. And the crime is very low in Nogales. They're one of the lowest crime rates. They have one of the lowest crime rates in the country. When Gene and I were kids and our families went down to Mexico, we saw that interaction that you're talking about. And there was a hole in the fence in Nogales, people walk through the hole to go buy their groceries at Safeway,
yeah.
and then they would go back through the hole to go home. I had an aunt and her husband who worked in Nogales and taught school, and they had children every day who came from Mexico and were in their classes. And I think maybe some of that still happens, but certainly not at the level that it had been.
Well, that's it. There was more of that. There was so much of that. And because of a few bad actors occasionally who, this happens so often in U.S. policy, an anecdote, right? And usually it's an anecdote that was blown out of proportion. But I had a wife that passed away, and she had relatives on the border. And some of the stories they told, and as far as the changes, they told a story about some difficulty with some people coming across the border. And it got blown up out of proportion in this family, is what I'm getting at, to where it was like you do an elementary school where you whispered in one kid's ear in one side of the room, and by the time it got to the other side of the room, it was a completely different. So I had heard the original story, and by the time I heard it from other members of the family, it was a completely different and much more violent and a completely inaccurate retelling of an incident of relatives on the border.
Well, that seems to happen quite a bit now.
Yeah, I don't want to imply that there's not any problems and that there isn't a problem with illegal immigration, undocumented immigration, that there are no problems whatsoever. I just think folks have to understand that the actual situation is very, very different, Mike, than the portrait you get in the press of invasions.
That's what I wanted to say. I have relatives back east. I got an email telling me how terrible the border was and then asking me to verify it. This is about 3 or 4 years ago. And from a relative, well, it must be terrible down there. And I said, no, man, I was there, you know. And then you just had to explain. And I had taken a trip to Douglas, Bisbee Douglas, in the time of this email. And he was just describing this, once again, far-right image of armed militia groups and migrants with blood on in their hearts, and I had to, you know, I think he was disappointed when I kind of told him the truth of what it was like down on the border even then. And of course, this is all pre-Trump, so I don't know that.
We've got 2 minutes left. Sue, why don't you tell us again how to connect up with you, and then Michael wrap up the show for today, and maybe tell folks what we're doing next week, if we have any idea whatsoever.
Okay, you can see about my book and about me at suelefevre.com. That's my website, suelefevre.com. And watch for me on Instagram and Twitter. And the book's name is No More Deaths. It's also the name of the organization, and the subtitle is Humanitarian Aid is Never a Crime, Saving Lives of Migrants.
And there's a lot of contact information in the back of the book of different organizations, Sue. Right. So I'm, you know, very generously telling people that there are other organizations besides yours.
It is a wonderful resource. Folks, we want to, like I say, pick up the book, No More Deaths, by Sue Lefevre. And it's a great resource for all of the migrant groups working in southern Arizona. We want to thank Democrats of the Red Rocks for their assistance in bringing Democratic perspective to you every week. Alessandra Solar, Executive Director of the ACLU, will be our guest on November 21st. Don't forget, that's Thursday, 8:30 a.m. is when breakfast starts at the Old Sedona Bar and Grill. The executive director of the ACLU will have some interesting stuff to say as a guest of door. We've got Democratic Perspective is available. The podcast is available at bbid.org. All our shows are available at bbid.org, folks. And check out our website.
been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZ. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.